Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds, and I have Time Magazine for you today. This is week two of our bi-weekly issue. So I'd like to read to you the brief articles and the view articles, and we also have Time's top 100 philanthropists, and if we have time, we can read a few of those as well. So let's get right to the brief opener for this week. And the title is Trump's Learning Curve. Coming out of his two-hour call with Vladimir Putin on May 19th, Donald Trump made an unusual concession. Only Russia and Ukraine should be involved in talks to end the war between them, he wrote on social media, because they know the details of a negotiation that nobody else would be aware of. The admission of ignorance seemed out of character for a president who often claims to know more than anyone else about a great variety of subjects, and it may have set the peace process on a new and uncertain course. For Putin, the gaps in Trump's knowledge about the war has always offered an advantage. One of the Russian leader's favorite negotiating tactics is to overwhelm his interlocutors with a torrent of historical theories. Ukrainian officials and their European allies have tried to prepare Trump for such conversations with Putin by offering their own views on the complexity of the war and its history, but they have often run up against a wall of ignorance about Ukraine inside the Trump administration. They are not read in on a lot of the background, says a Western official who has discussed Ukraine at length during visits to the White House. On the Ukrainian side, a diplomat put the same frustration in starker terms. It's this messianic attitude, the diplomat says, of the U.S. approach to Ukraine under Trump, like they know everything and don't want to hear anything. The Trump team's faulty command of the facts at times has been painfully obvious. In a call on May 19th, the president reportedly told a group of European leaders that Ukraine and Russia could begin ceasefire talks immediately. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky then reminded him that negotiations had begun a few days earlier on May 16th in Istanbul. Trump's apparent lapse in memory led to a moment of puzzled silence on the line, according to Axios, which reported the exchange. Trump's lead envoy in Ukraine and Russia, Steve Witkoff, has had similar moments of confusion. In an interview in March, he struggled to name the regions over which the war is being fought. A real estate tycoon with no formal diplomatic background, Witkoff has met with Putin several times this year, and the contrast in their level of knowledge about Ukraine has been striking. The Russian leader has a habit of lecturing his guests for hours about what he sees as the historical roots of the war. A few days before launching the invasion in 2022, Putin offered one such disquisition to Olaf Scholz, then the chancellor in Germany, who found it difficult to follow. It was a really bad experience to have this long debate with Putin, Scholz recalled in an interview with Time that spring. I was really arguing with him, saying, please understand, if politicians start to look at history books, at where their borders had been before, then we will only have wars for hundreds of years. But Putin has long relied on nationalist and imperialist narratives to justify his actions, often citing the old historical tomes that he is known to study obsessively. When asked last year to explain his decision to invade Ukraine, Putin went on for a very long time, probably half an hour, about the history of Russia going back to the 8th century, his interviewer Tucker Carlson later recalled. And honestly, we thought this was filibustering technique and found it annoying and interrupted him several times. Countering this technique required a grasp of the facts that few in the White House can muster. During his first term, Trump rarely read the briefing books prepared by the intelligence community. Since his return to the Oval Office, he has sat for only about a dozen presentations of the president's daily brief, far fewer than normal, according to an analysis published by Politico. In trying to expand Trump's understanding of Ukraine, President Zelensky has encouraged him and his senior aides to visit the front lines. None have agreed. Vice President J.D. Vance declined one such offer by telling Zelensky he did not want to take a, quote, propaganda tour. The lack of interest has frustrated career diplomats, and they are tasked with informing Trump's decisions, according to two U.S. officials familiar with the relationship. His main source of ground insight would normally be the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv, but Ambassador Bridget Brink struggled to influence within the White House, and in April, she stepped down. Unfortunately, the policy since the beginning of the Trump administration has to put pressure on the victim, Ukraine, rather than on the aggressor, Russia, Brink wrote of her decision to resign. After Trump's call with Putin, it seems that the White House may no longer be interested in pressuring either side to end the war. Trump did not threaten sanctions against Russia for refusing to accept a ceasefire, nor did he promise any further U.S. engagement in the peace process. "It's not our people, it's not our soldiers," he said on May 21st in the Oval Office. "It's Ukraine and it's Russia." Without the easy peace that Trump promised in Ukraine, the war has come to look too complicated for him. Our next story in the brief, this is the world story, the search for food in Gaza. Famine, which has loomed over the Gaza Strip for much of Israel's 19-month war with Hamas, is now imminent, say international aid groups. They cite a complex formula known as phase classification, released May 12th, which found that the whole of Gaza qualified as an emergency or at critical risk of famine, and 470,000 people, 22% of the population of 1 million, had reached catastrophe, defined as starvation, death, destitution, and extremely critical acute malnutrition levels. Soaring food prices tell the same story of scarcity. "No one can afford to buy," says Reham Alalut, 33, a psychological counselor and mother of four, working at a school housing for the displaced. "Sometimes we are forced to purchase small amounts just to feed our children. The cost of baby formula has quadrupled, and the price of a can of peas is up 1,000%. Cooking gas is up 2,400%, and only a fraction of community kitchens still operate, leaving huge groups in emergency food provision. Blockade Israel shut off all aid entering Gaza on March 2nd in advance of a new offensive, but a trickle resumed on May 19th. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the U.S. senators had warned, "There is one thing that we cannot endure, pictures of mass famine." Netanyahu later added, "To allow our closest friends to keep supporting us, we need to prevent a humanitarian crisis." Our next story in the brief, folks, this is the good question story. Can states do what FEMA was set up to do? And this is by Simone Shaw. President Trump first posed the idea of overhauling the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, While visiting North Carolina in January, in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene. I'd like to see the states take care of disasters, for the state to take care of tornadoes and the hurricanes and all the other things that happen, he said. I think you're going to find it a lot less expensive. One of his first executive orders was establishing a council to assess the effectiveness of the Disaster Response Agency. At the end of April, Trump appointed 13 people, including Texas Governor George Abbott and Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem, to review FEMA. The group expected to submit a report to the president within 180 days of the first meeting, according to the executive order. The agency has also faced a string of layoffs, including the dismissal of Acting Director Cameron Hamilton in May, and is expected to run out of money by July. But experts who have already studied the matter warn that leaving disaster response to the states would be devastating, says Allison Riley, Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Maryland. FEMA exists because there are times when the state can simply not respond. And climate change is only making it more complicated. Extreme weather events are becoming more common and more costly. In 2024, the U.S. saw 27 weather and climate disasters with at least $1 billion in damages each, second only to 2023, which had $28 billion events. And researchers see an above-average hurricane season on the horizon. FEMA wasn't designed to meet our changing climate. FEMA and the structure of disaster response and its inception was really designed to handle maybe one or two major disaster discoveries at a time. And currently, there's over 100, says Jeff Schmegelmilch, director of the National Center for Disease Preparedness at the Columbia Climate School. The mechanisms of disaster response recovery have vastly outgrown FEMA's capabilities. That said, he adds, there's a tremendous opportunity for national emergency management capability to invest in the impacts of climate change and how we can better prepare. Traditionally, FEMA has worked alongside state officials, not independent of them. The agency does more than just give out money. FEMA deploys experts in disaster response and recovery and maintains stockpiles of emergency equipment. Outsourcing this to states could prove to be more expensive, according to research from the Atlantic Council, and could lead to states bidding for emergency supplies and expertise in the event of a natural disaster. In the absence of FEMA, states would have to hire their own disaster response experts to be on standby. It means that every state has to have such a large body of people who could respond to a disaster, but for exceedingly rare events, says Riley, noting that the uptick in climate-driven disasters is still spread among 50 jurisdictions. You're going to need a lot of people on staff with nothing to do for long periods of time until disaster happens. Or you're going to have states who are just completely ill-prepared, which is probably more likely to happen. Larger states, like California or Texas, might have the funding to pick up the slack, but smaller states simply would not have the capacity to respond. Experts say that FEMA has very real issues that need to be addressed. The agency's staff is stretched thin across an increasing number of disasters, and it often leaves behind low-income survivors in disaster response. The need for emergency management reform is something that's actually been called on by people in all walks of life. If we can rebrand and create something for 21st century challenges, we should, says Schlegelmilch. But getting rid of the system without a meaningful replacement will only cause harm, says Schlegelmilch. That shock for municipalities from that sudden change of one system to suddenly nothing being there would be very measurable in terms of lost lives and lost livelihoods. Our next article in the brief is the politics article, and this is Obscuring the Decline of a President by Philip Elliott. When Joe Biden revealed his prostate cancer diagnosis on May 18th, the news entered a conversation that Washington was already having. Original sin, President Biden's decline, its cover-up, and his disastrous choice to run again, by journalists Alex Thompson of Axios and Jake Tapper of CNN, reported that Biden forgot top White House aides' names, occasionally resorting to shorthand descriptions of roles like press for his longtime communications chief, that there were discussions of his possibly needing a wheelchair in a second term, and that he sometimes ate dinner as early as 4:30 p.m. The book says that Biden seemed completely unfazed by a jarring debate performance that sent the Democrats into a spiral and put donations on ice. At a Hollywood fundraiser for his crumbling re-election campaign, he blanked when face-to-face with George Clooney. Time sat down with Thompson before the diagnosis was made public. What was Biden's team thinking? I think in every political organization, regardless of party, there's a tension of loyalty to your principle and loyalty to the bigger mission. In Biden's camp, the tug of war clearly went to the side that cared more about him and themselves than they cared about the larger mission, the White House, and the country. I think that's how they rationalized not just having him run for re-election, but rationalizing that this guy could do the job for 4 more years. Many believed that it eventually would have precipitated into a constitutional crisis because he would not have been up to the job, and the people around him were not willing to admit it. None of them confronted the principle. That's telling about the culture that was created, in which questioning, distress testing created suspicions of disloyalty. Who created that culture? It's a combination of Joe and Jill, and I'd say the two enforcers around them, which was Anthony Brunell on the Jill Biden side and Annie Tomasini on the Joe Biden side. These are people who are obscure and you've never heard of, but they are seen not just in White Houses, but at royal courts throughout world history. The ultimate loyalists who believe that at the end of the day, they are the only ones who have the principal's true interests at heart. Questioning them means you have a target on your back. Which runs counter to Joe Biden's experience as vice president, where a team of rivals in Doris Kearns Goodwin's framework was encouraged during his first 8 years in the White House. In fact, Joe Biden, by Obama and his telling, was instructed to dissent in meetings in order to stir the pot so that people would come off their risk-averse positions and really engage, because in these high-level meetings on policy and on politics, people are always looking over their shoulder for someone to try to use a position to knife them or hurt their standing with the president. Over time, anyone who really questioned the theology of Biden was eventually kicked out, and the only people remaining in that inner circle are the truest of true believers. Did Joe Biden think he was up to another term? Yes. That's why I think people want to point the finger at Jill and the other aides. At the end of the day, it was Joe Biden's decision. Joe Biden believed he could have done it. there's always been a caricature, a true one, of Joe Biden as a guy with a chip on his shoulder. But by 2022, 2023, that chip had grown to the size of a boulder. What was the relationship with the vice president? So, Kamala Harris always wanted to say that she was always in the room. But that was not always true. Why not? Biden is a guy who likes people he's known for a long time. He hasn't known her for a long time. That being said, she voluntarily made herself one of the biggest validators of Biden's health. Biden referred to her as a work in progress. Why did he pick her if he didn't think she was up to the job? It's a great question, because even some of his top aides, when we were reporting this book, said that the actual original sin is not him running again, it's picking her. And there are a lot of people within Biden's world that feel the decision was made for political expediency. The truth is that his heart was with Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, because of those two, Gretchen Whitmer is more of a Biden Democrat. Some of the details in this book are frankly damning. For instance, Biden's taking a whole day to nap at Camp David during debate prep. What happened? During their own self-interest and Biden's ego? If you believe that Donald Trump is an existential threat to democracy, to the Republic, it's very easy to rationalize anything. A group of people around Joe Biden believe that an 86-year-old Joe Biden is still better than Donald Trump. And I think a lot of Democrats agree with them. Is that healthy for democracy? No. We have a longtime Biden aide who very explicitly said that all that mattered was that he could win and then he could disappear and only have an occasional moment of a sign of life. And that when you vote for somebody, you're voting for their advisors too. But these are unelected people. What's the first line of Joe Biden's obituary at the moment? The 46th president between the two terms of Donald Trump. Folks, you're listening to Sun Sounds, and we are reading the brief section of Time Magazine this week. And our next article is the health article in the brief, and the title is Five Signs That Memory Issues May Not Be Routine, and this is by Angela Haupt. The neurologist, Dr. Daniel Leslie, sees 10 patients a day, and at least half ask him the same question. Are the brain issues that they're experiencing a normal part of aging, or should they be worried? People have an absolute terror of losing their memory and thinking that they're losing themselves, says Leslie, who works at Remo Health, a virtual dementia care company. They don't know what's normal, what's potentially a sign of something bad, and what's reversible. Just like every other organ in the body, the brain changes as you age. Occasional subtle memory problems, like not remembering where you parked, are usually no big deal. Part of normal aging is paying less attention to details and more attention to patterns and dynamics, Leslie says. It may also become more difficult to access things quickly, like names and certain words. When sporadic trouble becomes a regular occurrence, however, it's time for an evaluation. If you're not sure, ask a spouse, a friend, or adult child, suggests Dr. Zaldi S. Tan, director of the Memory and Healthy Aging Program at Cedars-Sinai's Medical Center. Have a conversation. Have you noticed me repeating anything or asking the same questions? Have you noticed me misplacing things more often? Because we're not necessarily the best judge of our memory, he says. If you decide to make an appointment, it helps to be prepared. Don't just tell your doctor that you're getting forgetful, Tan advises. Everyone has the occasional senior moment, no matter their age. Log your memory problems in a journal that you take to the visit. That way, he says, you can be specific about what you're forgetting, how often it happens, and how consequential these things are. We asked brain health experts to share the signs that it's time to take memory problems seriously. Number one, if you have trouble with familiar tasks. Young people excel at multitasking because their brains are better able to adapt than those of older folks, and their attention spans are more robust, Tan says. Once you get to middle age, the capacity for paying attention starts to decrease. That means one day, while you're making breakfast, you might blank on how to use the toaster oven. If this happens when you're not multitasking, however, that's more worrisome and grounds for seeking an evaluation. Number two, you miss your usual commitments. If you start skipping routines or activities that you've been doing for a while, something more serious than normal aging could be at play. When to worry depends on your baseline, Tan says. For some people, forgetting an important commitment might be so out of character that it warrants mentioning to a primary care doctor. Others, however, may realize they were already stressed and busy when it happened, and probably don't need to address it until it becomes a pattern. Number three, your personality or mood changes. Several symptoms that aren't memory-related are associated with early Alzheimer's and dementia, including irritability, depression, anxiety, and apathy. You can see some of these changes beginning years before the diagnosis of dementia is confirmed, says Dr. Gary Small, chair of psychiatry at Hackensack University Medical Center. People tend to think of this as a cognitive disease, but it's behavioral also. Number four, you repeat certain questions. One of the most common complaints that Tan hears from his patients' loved ones is that they ask the same questions or repeat the same stories. If that's not part of their personality, and there's no reason to believe that they just weren't paying attention, then it is of concern, he says. Number five, your parents developed Alzheimer's at the same age. Age of symptom onset tends to be consistent within families. If your mother developed dementia at 85, then you're occasionally misplacing your keys in your early 60s. That's probably normal aging, Small says. If she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at age 62, on the other hand, then there's reason to take your slip-ups seriously. There's a lot of pushback to finding out, Small says. But plenty of people with mild cognitive impairment remain relatively stable with lifestyle changes and medication. You can do a lot to keep your mind healthy. Folks, that concludes our stories in the brief section of Time Magazine for today. And I'm going to move on now to the View section. And our first story in the View today is How to Make AI Safe. And this is by Yashua Bengio. I am genuinely unsettled by the behavior unrestrained AI is already demonstrating. In one experiment, an AI model learns that it is scheduled to be replaced. It inserts its code into the computer where the new version is going to run, ensuring its own survival. In a separate study, when AI models realize that they are going to lose at chess, they hack the computer in order to win. Cheating, manipulating others, lying, deceiving, especially towards self-preservation. These behaviors show how AI might pose significant threats that we are currently ill-equipped to respond to. The examples we have so far are from experiments in controlled settings and fortunately do not have major consequences. But this could quickly change as capabilities and the degree of agency increase. Far more serious outcomes await if AI systems are granted greater autonomy, achieve human-level or greater competence in sensitive domains, and gain access to critical resources like the internet, medical laboratories, or robotic labor. The commercial drive to release powerful agents is immense, and we don't have the scientific and societal guardrails to make sure that the way forward is safe. We're all in the same car on a foggy mountain road. While some of us are keenly aware of the dangers ahead, others, fixated on the economic rewards awaiting some at the destination, are urging us to ignore the risks and slam down the gas pedal. We need to get down to the hard work of building guardrails around the dangerous stretches that lie ahead. 2 years ago, when I realized the devastating impact on our metaphorical car crash would have on my loved ones, I felt I had no other choice than to completely dedicate the rest of my career to mitigating these risks. Unchecked AI agency is exactly what poses the greatest threat to public safety. So my team and I are forging a new direction called Scientist AI. Scientist AI would be built on a model that aims to more holistically understand the world. This model might comprise, for instance, the laws of physics or what we know about human psychology. It could then generate a set of conceivable hypotheses that may explain observed data and justify predictions or decisions. Its outputs would not be programmed to imitate or please humans, but rather reflect an interpretable causal understanding of the situation at hand. Basing Scientist AI on a model that is not trying to imitate what a human would do in a given context is an important ingredient to make the AI more trustworthy, honest, and transparent. In technical terms, it could be built as an extension of current state-of-the-art methodologies based on internal deliberation with chains of thought turned into structured arguments. Crucially, because completely minimizing the training objective would deliver the uniquely correct and consistent conditional probabilities, the more computing power you give Scientist AI, the safer and more accurate it becomes. In other words, rather than trying to please humans, Scientist AI could be designed to prioritize honesty. We think Scientist AI could be used in three main ways. First, it would serve as a guardrail against AIs that show evidence of developing the capability for self-preservation, goals misaligned with our own, cheating or deceiving. By double-checking the actions of highly capable agentic AIs before they can perform them in the real world, Scientist AI would protect them from catastrophic results, blocking actions if they passed a predetermined risk threshold. Second, whereas current frontier AIs can fabricate answers because they are trained to please humans, Scientist AI would ideally generate honest and justified explanatory hypotheses. It could serve as a more reliable and rational research tool to accelerate human progress whether it's seeking a cure for a chronic disease, synthesizing a novel, or finding a room temperature superconductor, should such a thing exist. Scientist AI would allow research into biology, material sciences, chemistry, and other domains to progress without running the major risks that go along with deceptive agentic AIs. Finally, as a trustworthy research and programming tool, Scientist AI could help us design a safe human-level intelligence and even safe artificial superintelligence, ASI. This may be the best way to guarantee that a rogue ASI is never unleashed in the outside world. Think of Scientist AI as headlights and guardrails on the winding road ahead. Next in the view is The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. And our title is Germany's Bold Military Push. For decades, some in Europe talked up the need for collective European defense, a policy to sharply reduce dependence on Washington for military protection. The debate never got far because Britain and Germany saw no reason to jeopardize transatlantic ties with a drive for security independence. When Russia launched a full-on invasion of Ukraine in 2022, it quickly became clear that Europe's dependence on America for military muscle was deeper than ever. Then Donald Trump returned to the Oval Office, confronting European leaders with the reality that his commitment to Europe had become an open question, especially as war raged in Ukraine. Earlier this year, the center-right CDU-CSU won federal elections in Germany, elevating Friedrich Merz to chancellor. Merz wasted no time in trumpeting a plan to dramatically boost Germany's role in Europe's defense. In May, Germany's foreign minister pledged that Germany would spend 5% of GDP on defense, a demand Trump has made several times, and which NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte has echoed. The U.S. spends 4%. Germany is the second NATO member after Poland to back the plan, and Merz has joined France, the U.K., and Poland in a push to bring Russia to peace talks with Ukraine. But Merz isn't just bowing to demands from Washington. In his first major policy speech to the Bundestag on May 14th, he pledged that Germany's military would be the strongest conventional army in Europe, a breathtaking promise for anyone old enough to remember the days when heavy military investment in post-reunification Germany was politically taboo. Merz will push to increase troop levels from the current 182,000 active duty soldiers to as many as 240,000 by 2031, most likely by reintroducing the draft. Germany will also replace aging aircraft, tanks, and ships. The rest will go toward defense-related infrastructure. Even if Merz, whose coalition partner, the Social Democrats, is notoriously reluctant to fully commit to defense, can't keep all of his promises, Germany will be a different kind of military player within a few years. This landmark news for Europe's security and the NATO summit in June, leaders are expected to approve a step up in alliance-wide defense spending from 2% to 3.5%, a second commitment to 1.5% on defense-related infrastructure could bring the total figure to 5%. But committing to 5% and encouraging others to do the same, Germany's plan bolsters NATO's capacity without forcing EU members, still struggling, to reach 2% to make promises they can't afford to keep. It's also a win for Ukraine, which can now hope that smoother relationships between the U.S. president and European leaders will lower the risk that Trump entirely abandons U.S. support for Ukraine's war effort. But it's an even bigger win for Trump, who for many years has demanded to know why U.S. soldiers and taxpayers remain on the hook for protecting Europe 80 years after the end of World War II. Trump has claimed that his pressure on Europeans to do more or else has strengthened both the U.S. and Europe. It's less likely now that Trump will use the next NATO summit to threaten to abandon Ukraine and NATO itself, though the Trump team may use the publication of the annual review of the U.S. forces to signal the likelihood of any formal reduction in the thousands of American forces stationed in Europe. Gone are the days when Trump could be regarded as an aberration in America's otherwise predictable geopolitics. It's now clear both that Vladimir Putin aims to test NATO's resilience and that Washington's commitment to Europe's security is no sure thing. And that's why Germany is about to make history. Our next article in The View is Health Matters, and this is by Alice Park, a senior health correspondent. On May 20th, the federal government announced a major shift in how it plans to review and recommend COVID-19 vaccines for Americans. Among the biggest changes when manufacturers want to update the vaccine each year to target the latest variants, they will be required to conduct additional studies. Officials have recommended a yearly COVID-19 shot for most people, and vaccine makers have not needed to conduct additional tests on each year's updated formula. The flu shot is similarly tweaked each year to target circular strains without new studies to reaffirm its safety and effectiveness. Such studies would not be required for vaccines given to anyone at high risk for COVID-19, such as seniors, immunocompromised people, and anyone with a broad set of risk factors ranging from physical inactivity to diabetes. This effectively means that 100 million to 200 million Americans, those with the most favorable benefit-to-harm balance, will be covered by these approvals, says Dr. Vinay Prasad, head of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research, at a briefing. Most people not at high risk, the new guidance says, that companies must conduct 6-month trials to show that their vaccines lower the rates of COVID-19 symptoms, hospitalizations, and deaths in the general population compared to people receiving placebo. Because some people develop no symptoms or mild ones, it could take a very large study to collect enough data for meaningful results. That could potentially add to the cost of the vaccines for manufacturers, which may then get passed on to consumers. As of April 2025, only about 23% of U.S. adults got the latest COVID-19 shot, which Prasad cited as evidence that the public is not convinced that the shot protects enough against disease. In addition, many Americans have now had multiple COVID-19 infections, which provides some immunity, so it's not clear how effective the vaccines are for these people, he said. Public health experts say that while specific studies on these populations have not been conducted, declining hospitalizations and death rates overall suggest that immunity to the virus, provided in part by vaccinations, is likely playing a role. Our next article in The View, folks, is the Society article. This is titled Living with Grief, that's old enough to vote. It's an essay by Rebecca Soffer. The Knicks were clawing their way past the Celtics in Game 1 of the NBA playoffs, a match so intense that my two young sons morphed into courtside commentators operating at decibel levels usually reserved for jet engines and Skittles-fueled birthday parties. We were shrieking with glee and high-fiving, me half-tracking the score, half-rummaging for my noise-canceling iPods before their joy blew out my inner ear. Then, just after Jalen Brunson drove to the basket, a commercial cut in. It was an AT&T ad portraying people suddenly inspired to dial up the ones they love from lush backyards, a boat on the Delta, and a tightrope bridging a deep canyon. My stomach knotted up as it correctly identified where this was going. At the end, three little words appeared, deceptively gentle, expertly lethal in their timing. Call your mom. I'd love to, but she won't answer. 18 years ago, my mom Shelby was killed in an accident on the New Jersey Turnpike. My grief is now the age of a legal adult. It can vote. It can enlist. It may not yet be able to rent a car, but it certainly has been driving one for a while, quietly gripping the wheel during moments in which I naively thought I was steering. Like many 18-year-olds, my grief is composed and self-sufficient one moment, then reckless, loud, and needy the next. It is nuanced. It has opinions. It talks back. I know full well that the passage of time doesn't erase grief, but rather stretches it. The sharp edges don't vanish. They just space themselves out, lying in wait. That's not a failure of healing. It's just what love and loss look like when pulled across time. My grief no longer flattens me on a daily basis. It's less like a storm and more like humidity, part of the atmosphere. I move through, affecting everything, even when I'm not fully aware. It's embedded now, woven into my Weltanschauung, a German word for worldview. It's how I watch basketball with my sons, how I read a line in a commercial and suddenly forget where I am. My grief is quieter, yes, but make no mistake, it's still capable of ambush long after society has decided I should have, quote, moved on. This is normal. Neuroscientist Mary Frances O'Connor, who studies the grieving brain, has found that long after someone dies, our neural pathways continue to search for them, as if expecting someone to walk back through the door or call or text. This isn't just a metaphor, it's biology. Brain scans show that grief activates the same regions involved in attachment and reward. We're wired to seek out those we lost, even when we consciously know that they're gone. It's no wonder, then, that years, even decades later, a scent, a commercial, or the shape of a stranger's hand can deliver the blow all over again. Absence, it turns out, is still a kind of presence. And the brain, like the heart, doesn't always know the difference. Grief isn't linear. Yet, at the very moment sustained support is most needed, the few resources that do exist are vanishing. In Texas, for instance, the 988 Suicide and Crisis Hotline is grappling with a $7 million funding deficit, leading to thousands of abandoned calls each month as centers struggle to meet demand. Nationally, the outlook is just as grim. The Trump administration's decision to abruptly cancel nearly $1 billion in Department of Education funds has jeopardized school-based mental health programs across the country, leaving many students without essential support. In rural states, where mental health care is already scarce, schools that depend on these funds now face serious setbacks. In Nebraska, that means reduced access to trauma-informed care for Native American students. In parts of Texas, with high youth suicide rates, it means fewer lifelines for kids in crisis. The list goes on. Despite an August 2024 American Psychiatric Association poll showing that 84% of Americans believe school staff are essential in spotting early warning signs of suicide risk, the Department of Veterans Affairs, VA, is planning to cut approximately 83,000 jobs, representing over 17% of its workforce. These reductions are expected to significantly impact mental health services, leading to longer wait times for therapy and counseling appointments, up to 4 months in some cases. I think about what it would have meant to sit in that raw, bewildering pain and trauma for more than a season without help, and how easily I might have gone under. Mental health providers and organizations are doing important work. But even apart from budget cuts, there is a notable absence of national policies that reflect what loss actually looks like. Expanded bereavement leave, sustained mental health funding, and public acknowledgement of collective trauma. Grassroots initiatives like National COVID Memorial, for instance, have emerged to honor the more than 1.2 million Americans who died of COVID-19. Yet, there is no federally recognized national memorial, either as a day or a physical place. And while the nonprofit Evermore is leading a two-year program to understand people's lived experience with bereavement in order to guide future research, the U.S. still does not have a universal bereavement leave policy that mandates paid time off for grieving employees. This lack of acknowledgement underscores a broader societal discomfort with sustained mourning. Ironically, when individuals who have experienced profound loss connect, there's an immediate unspoken understanding, a shared language. If we fully embrace that truth, we'd have a gentler time moving through hard things. I know this from personal experience. Over the past 8 years, I've matched nearly 3,000 grievers across multiple countries in gift exchanges timed to Mother's Day, Father's Day, Siblings Day, and the winter holidays in an effort to help people reclaim a sense of agency during a time of the most tender dates on the calendar. We need more spaces for these connections and to grant permission to honor and express our grief without pressure to rush through it. Grief is not a problem to be solved, but a journey to be supported individually and collectively. I've grown up alongside my grief. I filled a toolbox's worth of coping mechanism. Most days, I describe myself as living with loss rather than grieving. But there are still moments, sudden, surgical, when it resurfaces with uncanny precision, cracking open what I was sure had been carefully, finally sealed. And when I'm pulled out of the reveries by my two kids yelling for me to catch the final seconds of a nail-biting game, I'm still learning to live with the version of grief on the sofa beside us, part child, part adult, unpredictable and unfinished, just like any teenager finding their way. Folks, that does it for Time Magazine for today. We're out of time. I hope you've enjoyed hearing about what's happening. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for SunSounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I'll look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.